Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You've probably heard that exercise is good for mental health. A recently published study in Lancet Psychiatry underscores that phenomenon, suggesting that people who exercise on a regular basis enjoy mental well-being 40% more than those who do not exercise. You've also probably heard the old adage that about too much of a good thing. Science journalist with Outside Magazine, Alex Hutchinson, recently reviewed the study. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
The results of the study weren't affected by age, race, gender, marital status, income, education level, or even previous diagnosis of depression. I mean, were there any factors that mitigated this?
Yeah, one of the nice things about the study is that they surveyed 1.2 million people as part of a larger study.
That's big.
That's about as big as it gets. You can imagine the data processing challenge. But that allowed them to sort of compare like with like and figure out how all these factors that you mentioned sort of remove those effects. So everyone's different, but I think it's a pretty safe blanket statement that exercise will definitely help your mental health.
You talked about the chicken or the egg situation, I guess causation versus the alternative.
Correlation,
right. Do people feel better because they exercise or do they exercise because they feel good? How does this study address that issue?
Yeah, so I think the answer to your question is yes, or both. Exercise makes you feel good, but also it's undoubtedly true that people who are feeling good, who aren't, say, stuck in a period of depression, are more likely to get out the door and exercise. And so this study, because it was taken at a single point in time, it was one survey of each person, they can't distinguish between those two effects. So when we say, you know, people who exercised had 40% fewer, instances of poor mental health, the real effect is probably a little smaller than that, because part of that is created by the fact that people who are feeling good get out the door and exercise more. So on this study alone can't prove which way the arrow of causation is going. But there are a lot of other studies where they've tried controlled studies where they said, let's take a bunch of people, ask half of them to exercise, and then see how their mental health compares to those who didn't exercise, and they do tend to also suggest that exercise does improve mental health.
And when we talk about exercise, what do we mean?
Well,
just for the sake of refreshing our memories, because people do different things.
Yeah, and there's actually a sort of subtle distinction between exercise and physical activity. When scientists talk about exercise, they mean you're deliberately going out there and doing something with the goal of making yourself fitter. But a lot of us, as I look out the window here and see the leaves that are about to fall down and think of all the raking I'm going to have to do over the next few months, we get a lot of physical activity that doesn't necessarily classify as exercise. And so there's a little bit of a debate as to how much benefit you get just from the activities of daily living. And I think that depends on whether, you know, how active your daily life is. But the truth is your brain doesn't know whether you're lifting weights or, you know, hauling bags of leaves. So the important thing is to be active in some context, whether it's a specific workout, whether it's a brisk walk, or whether it's just running errands.
Is there a perfect amount of exercise?
Yeah, this is the part of the study that I found interesting and maybe took a little bit of issue with, because they did identify a sweet spot based on their data, saying that people who exercise 3 to 5 times a week for between 30 and 60 minutes at a time seem to see the biggest benefits. And I think that's pretty reasonable. And if someone asked me, hey, I want to make sure that I'm doing everything I can for both my physical and mental health, how much should I exercise? I would say, hey, 3 to 5 times a week for 30 to 60 minutes sounds great. But I think we need to be careful before we imply that if you're exercising, 6 times a week or for 61 minutes, you're actually hurting yourself. Because I think that's a mistake to make that assumption, because, again, we go back to this correlation versus causation thing. Some of the people who are exercising 7 days a week for 2 hours at a time, that may actually be a result of them. They're trying to manage mental health issues like obsessive personality issues or eating disorders or things like that. So in terms of whether it's a sweet spot, I would say there's more like a lower threshold. Try and aim for 3 to 5 times a week, 30 to 60 minutes a week. If you enjoy getting out for a walk more than that, or for a jog or a bike ride or whatever it is you like to do, I don't think you need to worry that you're too high for the sweet spot.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the relationship between exercise and mental health. My guest is Alex Hutchinson. He's a science journalist with Outside Magazine. He reviewed the results of a recent study published in Lancet Psychiatry that underscores the idea that exercise is good for mental health with certain limitations. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you're saying exercise more often is the best route, not lengthy exercises, but more often.
Yeah, if you're into 3-hour bike rides, that's great. But you may get a lot out of that. But I think that's not what you need to do if you're aiming for more health. And if I was to add an additional sort of suggestion that's maybe not in this particular study, it would be things you can do outside and or with friends.
Why is that?
The second part with friends, there's also lots of an independent sort of a separate stream of research showing that social connections are really important for mental health. And so, playing sports, like whether it's playing a game of tennis with a friend or going for a run with friends or whatever the case may be, that it kind of gives you a 2-in-1 jolt where you're getting the benefits of exercise, but also you're fostering social connections. And it also has some practical benefits. It's harder to bail out on a workout or a tennis game if you know that your friend is waiting at the tennis courts wondering where you are.
I like classes.
Yeah, well, that's a great opportunity. For one thing, you've got a bunch of people there, so you're having some social interaction. For another thing, you may have paid some money to be in the class, and so it's harder to walk away from that and skip it. So, I think also having someone tell you what to do, having someone lead you and guide you can take some of the load where you're, if you're out there and you're not really sure, should I be lifting this, should I be going harder or easier, it's great to have someone with expertise to guide you through it.
What happens when you're getting too much exercise? I mean, it's different for everybody, for one thing. I mean, you're kind of, I think you're an elite athlete, aren't you, a runner, or you were?
Let's say a former elite athlete.
A former elite athlete, okay. Obviously, you, an elite athlete, runs more. Somebody who's training for, the marathon does more.
Yeah, and I think that's another complicating factor when we talk about the sweet spot, because if I say go for a walk 3 times a week, for some people that's actually a big commitment. For someone who hasn't been exercising before, and that may be challenging for them. For me, I'm used to running every day. For let's say I ran 10K just before this phone call. So going for a walk for half an hour doesn't challenge my body at all, and so I'm not going to get those responses, that extra rush of blood to the brain and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So thresholds like that are very personal, figuring out what's challenging you without breaking you down. And so you want to be tired at the end of a workout, but you don't want to, be laid up in bed for 2 days. So you have to find that balance. And it's really impossible to say there's one level of exercise that's going to work for everyone. You have to adjust it for what you're used to, what you're comfortable with. And so there's that's the physical aspect of, are you doing too much? Can you recover? When you get to the really high levels of exercise, where if you're spending an hour or a couple hours a day, then it also becomes a mental stress and a logistical stress finding the times, and it's maybe crowding out opportunities for social interactions or family time and things like that. So there's definitely a point where if you're training really, really seriously, it's no longer a sort of pleasant thing that's made. You may choose to do it if you're an Olympic athlete or an aspiring Olympic athlete, but you're no longer. It's no longer sort of in that optimal zone for mental health. Maybe.
How do you suss out whether it's physical strain or mental strain when you're doing a long workout?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question and one that athletes struggle a lot with. If you're pushing hard, you're definitely going to have the feeling that, I'm tired and I want to stop. And athletes are always trying to figure out, is this my body telling me I need to slow down or I need to back off? Or is this just my mind playing tricks on me? And, it takes some experience to figure out the difference. But for the most part, you should be able to push comfortably and or to push yourself and feel some discomfort and sustain that for a little while. And then when you stop, the discomfort should go away and you should be relatively recovered. You know, half an hour later, you should be back to your normal self. If you find you're for the rest of the day, you're kind of having trouble, you know, walking upstairs and so on, you probably pushed you a little too hard physically at that point.
There's also a certain anxiety that is associated with pushing yourself, you know, even if it's something like a plank, you know, sometimes you got to watch it.
Yeah, I think, well, one really important thing is familiarity versus unfamiliarity. If you're pushing yourself into some activity you've never pushed yourself in before, you're a little worried if you're going to pull something, if you're going to hurt yourself, if you're going to do some damage. As you get comfortable pushing your limits, there's a really good argument for being progressive and gradual in your exercise routines. Don't try and go from 0 to 60 in your first week of exercise, because as long as you're only doing a little bit more than you've done before, I find that really helps to limit the amount of anxiety that you're feeling. But it's also, I think, if you do feel anxiety or fear or stress while exercising, it's worth trying to think about where that anxiety is coming from. Are you worried about whether you're going to achieve, you know, your weight loss goals? Are you worried about the fact that it's going to hurt if you exercise hard? Are you worried about other things in your life? Are you unable to sort of stop stressing about work? And so there can be a lot of different reasons for feeling stressed, and some of them are totally natural and understandable, and some of them are maybe a reason to think that you should kind of address those issues.
Is exercise addiction a real thing?
Yeah, I think the term is kind of a loaded term. Oftentimes this comes from sort of brain scanning studies where you have people exercise and parts of their brain associated with addiction and reward light up. But the truth is, you can wave anything nice in front of people, whether it's an ice cream cone or money or whatever, and people will have this response that they, you know, their brain will light up. And we don't, you know, the line between are people addicted in the sense that they can't live without it, or do they just really, really like ice cream? And I think for most people, the same is true with exercise. People who are really, you know, into exercise may become very, very fond of it. Most of them aren't addicted to it. Some people are. There are people with psychological addictions, and that's often tied up with eating disorders and things like that. And these are very, very serious issues that are very hard to unravel and generally require professional help. But I think the average person who may go to the gym every day and spend an hour there and really enjoys exercise, that's not addiction. That's just finding something that they really enjoy.
There's a lot of emphasis on doing a variety of activities, not just running all the time, but maybe throwing in a yoga class or a spinning class or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a good emphasis. And also, I can speak as someone who runs every day, but also, and if I was sort of left to my own devices, I probably would just choose to run. But I've made a deliberate effort to say, you know what, it'll be better for me if I'm using different parts of my body. So I've started rock climbing once a week, and I've started playing basketball with some friends once mm-hmm. a week, and trying to incorporate other activities. So I think that's a good thing. I don't think you need to it's not like a disaster. If you find something you really love, that's better than watching TV, right? So mm-hmm. It's like variety is like having spinach and broccoli on your plate. It's great. But if you end up just having broccoli, that's still pretty good.
Alex Hutchinson, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Anne. I enjoyed it.
Alex Hutchinson, he's a science journalist with Outside Magazine, and he reviewed a recently published study in Lancet Psychiatry that underscores the idea that if you exercise on a regular basis, you're going to be have better mental well-being. But you don't want to overdo it. So more Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The typically American life in the 21st century looks and probably feels very different from those of our ancestors of yore, but we all still have the same need for sleep. What has changed is whether we get enough. Neurologist and sleep physician at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle, Dr. Brandon Peters, recently wrote about our lack of sleep. For the conversation, he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Once again, why do we need so much sleep? 8 hours seems like a lot to a lot of people now.
Yeah, so the average sleep need is between 7 and up to 9 hours. So some people even need more than that average of 8 hours. And we certainly have plenty of things to keep us occupied and busy during the day. So it can be hard to meet that sleep need. But if we don't, I think we suffer and our health suffers when we don't get enough.
I think a lot of people try to get the 8 hours of sleep, but they just don't sleep very well.
Yeah, that's certainly possible as well. About 10% of the population experiences chronic insomnia, so that's a difficulty either getting to sleep or difficulty getting back to sleep after waking. And there's certainly other common sleep disorders, the most common being sleep apnea. Restless legs is also something that might disturb sleep. And if you're not getting good sleep quality or unable to have continuous sleep through the night, that may be something that should be brought to medical attention.
Does our society value sleep? You know, we hear about the siestas in certain countries and that kind of the afternoon break, but that's like, you know, oh, no way in the United States.
Yeah, see, there definitely are cultural influences on sleep, and sleep is not just a physiological need, but also a behavior. And certainly countries near the equator, the heat of the day, they escape by enjoying some of that siesta time or taking afternoon nap, and that allows them to stay up a little bit later into the evening. They get to enjoy their cena or their dinner a little bit later and stay up a little bit later when the night is cooler. But in the U.S., we certainly value production and productivity, and we seem to think sleep is something that takes away from our ability to be as productive as we want to be.
You write that you should only go to sleep when you're sleepy. What is that anymore? I mean, how do you know when you're sleepy?
So, yeah, sleepiness is different than fatigue or tiredness or low energy or exhaustion. So the feeling of sleepiness or drowsiness is that feeling that comes right before you fall asleep. So your eyelids are getting heavy. There's a warm sensation. You're feeling quite relaxed. And it will help you to transition to sleep a little bit quicker if you go to bed with that sense of sleepiness. We often say, okay, it's 10 o'clock, it's my bedtime, I've got to get to bed. But you may or may not be feeling sleepy at that time. And if you think about it in terms of a food or appetite, you don't just eat at a specific time. You may have had a late lunch, or you may be busy and not be able to eat at that time, but you have a little bit of flexibility and variability, and you respect your sense of hunger. Same should be true for sleep. You should go to bed roughly at the same time every day, but if you're not feeling drowsy or sleepy, it's really in your interest to stay up a little bit later so that you can fall asleep faster when you do get to bed.
We know that adults in our society have a hard time with sleep. They may try to get the sleep. They can't for any number of reasons. When I was a kid, I never had a problem sleeping, but I wonder about kids today with the stimulation that they get from electronic devices.
Yeah, so children need more sleep than adults, and I mean, they may need 10 or even 12 hours of sleep, depending on their age, and they tend to get that sleep, or they become either irritable or sometimes even hyperactive as a result of sleep deprivation. We really have routines for our children's sleep. So often younger children, we go through a nightly routine. We're taking a bath, we're reading a book. So that helps to prepare them to fall asleep. And I think adults similarly would benefit from that. Shutting down electronics the hour or two before bedtime, the screen light can certainly be something that affects our circadian rhythms and may delay our ability to fall asleep. And just interacting with these devices is stimulating. If we're on Facebook, it might be something that's upsetting that wakes us up and gets us thinking, that makes it hard for us to shut down. So it's good to protect that time before bed, that hour or two spent unwinding, reading, listening to quiet music, maybe watching a familiar movie, just to prepare our body and mind for sleep.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sleep. It's a common topic on Wellness Wednesdays these days because we know that not enough people get enough sleep. My guest is Dr. Brandon Peters. He's a neurologist and sleep physician at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Peters, what do we know about why children sometimes dogs become hyperactive when they're sleep deprived. What's the connection there?
Yeah, so it's sort of a paradoxical response. In adults with a lack of sleep or poor quality sleep, more likely to become sleepy or drowsy, want to take naps during the day. Children have kind of the opposite reaction. So when they don't get a good quality sleep because of untreated sleep apnea or other sleep disorders, or they just don't get enough sleep, they actually become hyperactive. And this probably is a protective measure. They're behaving in a hyperactive way to keep themselves awake. So they're moving around a lot. They're engaged with lots of different environmental stimuli. But what we find is a lot of children with diagnoses of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they may have an underlying sleep disorder. And if they have snoring, that may be a sign that they potentially have sleep apnea. And the good news is once you treat that underlying condition, if you treat their sleep apnea, for example, you can often improve their behaviors during the day, their attention during the day, and that might allow them to get away from using other medications, stimulant medications that would be used to treat those attention conditions.
What about naps during the day? Can that, you know, you said we should sleep when we're sleepy, but sometimes I'm worried about taking a nap because it's going to start messing everything up.
Yeah, most people feel drowsy, sleepy in the afternoon, often between 1 and 3 p.m. That's the natural kind of circadian dip that we experience. So the circadian signal is an alerting signal when it fades in the early afternoon. So if you didn't get enough sleep or didn't get good quality sleep, that's often the time that you would feel drowsy or sleepy. If you do take a nap, I would recommend that it's kept short. Often naps are a way we kind of catch up on lost sleep, but certainly if it's late in the day or a prolonged nap, it may impact your ability to fall asleep that next night. So our bodies really like regular sleep schedules. I would especially pay attention to getting up at the same time every day, trying to get some morning sunlight right upon awakening. In the northern latitudes in the winter months, you may even think about using a light box to have an artificial source of light, because that actually is a signal for the brain to be more awake during the day and helps to regulate your sleep timing.
And as far as food and when you eat, how does that affect sleep?
So most people should be eating at least several hours before they go to bed. It takes about that much time for the food to pass from the stomach into the intestine. And that will help to avoid any sort of reflux or heartburn symptoms at nighttime. Food seems to be a signal for wakefulness. It prompts a release of insulin, and that may be something that wakes us. So a small snack at bedtime would probably be okay, but definitely avoid caffeine. Caffeine is something that the half-life is 4 to 6 hours. So if you're very sensitive, you may have to cut it out by mid-afternoon or even earlier potentially. But caffeine is something that you don't want to have kind of late in the evening, especially if you're sensitive to it. And alcohol is something that also impacts sleep. It takes about an hour to metabolize an alcoholic beverage. You probably want to wait an hour or two before bedtime between your last drink and when you're going to sleep. Historically, we use nightcaps as a way to go to sleep. It builds the signal of adenosine, which makes us feel sleepy. But unfortunately, we metabolize it so quickly that it begins to fragment sleep and affect the quality of our sleep.
Why can some people drink caffeine late in the day and others not? I can't drink it. You know, I have it in the morning and that's pretty much it. Maybe I'll have an iced tea at lunch, but some people can drink a Coke at night and I look on and wonder.
So caffeine is blocking, adenosine is blocking a signal for sleepiness. And certainly some people are more sensitive to that, maybe metabolize it in a different way or more quickly. And if you have very high levels of adenosine, you're sleep deprived, or perhaps you're getting a poor quality of sleep, you may have an underlying sleep disorder, caffeine may not impact you. You may have it right at bedtime and still be able to fall asleep quite easily because your adenosine levels are so high that even that bit of caffeine that you're drinking is not going to have an impact.
Is snoring by definition sleep apnea?
Not necessarily. Not everybody who snores has sleep apnea, and vice versa. Not everyone with sleep apnea necessarily snores. They tend to be on a continuum, though. So snoring is a vibration of the tissues within the airway. Sleep apnea is when the base of the tongue or the soft palate, the uvula, partially or completely block the throat. And certainly oxygen levels will drop, carbon dioxide levels will come up, and it will trigger an awakening or an arousal that fragments sleep. And there can be other symptoms associated with sleep apnea as well. People sometimes will grind their teeth or get up to pee frequently at night. They may have witnessed pauses in breathing, gasping, choking, heartburn at night or even irregular heartbeats and palpitations at night. Mm.
What should do some people, is it helpful to just put your head down on your desk if you're at work, shut the door if you can, or find a place where you can lie down and rest during the day? Is there's a lot of pressure not to do something like that.
Yeah, and I think that's shifting a little bit. There certainly are companies that are understanding the importance of sleep, not only for productivity, but also for the quality of work that's performed. There are certainly companies that have nap rooms and other spaces to encourage that rest and reset. And I think if you get adequate sleep at night, both quantity as well as quality, most people aren't going to need to take naps during the day, but if you're especially busy or feeling stressed, it might be nice to have 5 or 10 minutes just to close your eyes and reset. And that might be a time that you're being mindful or doing breathing exercises mm-hmm. or guided imagery or something else just to help kind of reset the day.
Can a snack help around that 3 o'clock time?
It can. So something light. I wouldn't go for the things that are high in sugar and carbs. When we sleep poorly, we definitely affect appetite-regulating hormones. So leptin and ghrelin are two that are impacted by sleep deprivation and poor quality sleep. And when we don't sleep enough, we tend to want high sugar, high carbs, certainly things with caffeine in them. And that may lead to longer-term weight gain, and weight gain certainly can cause snoring and sleep apnea to worsen. So it becomes a cycle where you're not sleeping well, you're eating the wrong foods during the day, and then you start to gain weight, which actually makes your sleep worse.
We have an email. They ask, is there any truth to the whole circadian rhythm thing, or can you get your sleep in spurts? I tend to have an irregular sleep pattern and just wondered if that has any negative effects.
So that's a great question. Certainly, most people are going to benefit from having a regular sleep schedule, so consistency with their wake time and their bedtime. Sleep can be divided up. So if you think about it in terms of food, you don't necessarily need to eat 3 meals a day. You could eat all of your calories in one meal. You could eat your calories over 5 or 6 smaller meals during the day. So the same is probably likewise true for sleep, that you can divide up sleep, have it in shorter periods. Now, the average sleep cycle is about 2 hours. So to complete a cycle, you probably want to sleep for at least a period of that length. But most people are going to benefit from a longer period of sleep, 6 to 8 hours overnight. Some people can have another period of sleep during the day in which they're catching up on the additional sleep that they need. It's normal to wake up at night. That's something that's important to recognize. That's a normal part of sleep. You awake every few hours. You may not remember those awakenings. You may just change positions. Potentially you might get up to go to the bathroom or something, but it is normal to wake in the night, and everyone experiences a certain number of awakenings that can be just a normal part of sleep.
What do you mean by the sleep cycle? Is that the REM sleep that you're shooting for, or what?
Yeah, so you start in wakefulness, of course. You'll go into lighter stages of sleep, stage 1 and 2, and then early in the night you'll hit slow wave sleep, which is stage 3, and then about 90 minutes to 2 hours into the night, you'll hit your first REM period, so rapid eye movement. Very vivid dreams. The muscles of the body are paralyzed, so you don't act your dreams out. And the shorter REM periods are early in the night, but by morning, you might be spending most of the time actually in that dreaming sleep. So it's very common for someone to wake up and remember a dream first thing in the morning. Just because you don't remember dreams doesn't mean you're not having REM sleep. You may transition to a different state of sleep and then wake before you come to consciousness, and you may not remember dreams in that context.
Go back to something you said a second ago about some kind of paralysis that sets in so you don't act your dreams out. What's going on there?
Yeah, so during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, the body is paralyzed. So the only muscles that are active are the diaphragm to allow us to continue to breathe, and then the muscles of the eyes. So our eyes are rapidly moving around with the lids closed, and we are still breathing, but all the other muscles of the body are paralyzed. So that also potentially paralyzes the muscles of the airway, and that's a time when people are more likely to have snoring or sleep apnea potentially. And there's a condition actually called REM sleep behavior disorder where that muscle loss is actually, that loss of muscle tone is actually not present. So the person is able to act their dreams out. They're able to physically hit or kick or roll out of bed and act their dreams out. And that's typically in older people beyond the age of 50, often men more than women. But that's a condition that can be treated, but it may be a harbinger of developing other conditions like Parkinson's disease.
Huh. Is that why, you know, people say I tried to scream, but I couldn't in the dream?
Yes, that can be part of a dream, and sometimes that can really come into wakefulness as well. So you wake up, you're frozen in place, you feel like you can't move. You might hallucinate that something's going on in your room, somebody's standing over you, you feel like you're breathing somewhat impaired. That's just the intrusion of REM sleep into wakefulness, and that's often called sleep paralysis, but other countries call it old hag. There's different ways that it's described, but that's very common. Probably about 1 in 4 people have experienced that.
Why is it that you experience that more as you age?
So perhaps part of it can be related to sleep fragmentation. So as we get older, certainly beyond the age of 65, we need a little bit less sleep. The average sleep need decreases to 7 to 8 hours. And if you don't reduce your time in bed to reflect that new sleep need, you're going to spend more time awake either at the beginning of the night, or the middle of the night. Your sleep becomes lighter and more fragmented. And the other thing is there are other conditions that develop as we get older that might fragment sleep, including sleep apnea and restless legs, among others. But that's probably the combination of the change in our sleep needs as well as those other sleep disorders that develop.
And you've mentioned restless legs a couple times. What is that?
So restless legs is an unpleasant feeling in the legs that occurs usually in the evenings when a person is lying down or sitting still. It involves an urge to move, and that feeling, that uncomfortable feeling, is relieved by the movement. It's a clinical diagnosis, so if you have that set of symptoms, we would say that you have that condition. It can be treated often with iron replacement if a person is iron deficient, but there are other medicines that we use to treat it as well. So it is disruptive and impacting quality of life.
And finally, before I let you go, what do you recommend to people about when they should seek, you know, when they should talk to their doctor about sleep issues? How long should you wait?
So I think if sleep is impacting your quality of life, I would certainly seek evaluation, whether you have difficulty getting to sleep or your sleep is of poor quality or excessively sleepy during the day. I would certainly get evaluated. The good news is sleep disorders can be easily treated, and within several months, you can get back to more normal sleep.
Dr. Brandon Peters, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Dr. Brandon Peters is a neurologist and a sleep physician at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle. He recently wrote about our lack of sleep for The Conversation. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 11 million people in the United States use e-cigarettes, which have gained popularity as a safe alternative to tobacco smoking, but there are still dangers. Just this morning, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, announced 5 major e-cigarette brands that must submit plans on how they'll reduce adolescent and teen use of their products. A new analysis of data from the Centers for Disease Control found that more than half of the people who vape and use these e-cigarettes also smoke regular cigarettes. Johns Hopkins Hospital researcher Dr. Hassan Mirbolouk is lead author of the study. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So is the problem that they're vaping and smoking tobacco, or is it bad to vape in general?
So it's a very complicated picture. So one part of it, as you said, are the dual users, which are those who are currently smoking and vaping in the same time. We are worried about these people because initially these electronic cigarettes were introduced as a smoking cessation device. But some people turns out to be clinging to both products. And this is the pattern that is unacceptable for healthcare providers.
So if you vape and smoke, have you erased all the gains from vaping, or maybe you smoke cigarettes less?
it depends. Some people vape and they reduce the amount of smoking, and some people smoke the same amount of cigarette and vape in the same time. So we just want to make sure that just picking up vapors does not mean that you're doing a good thing.
How much study was there done on vaping before it hit the market?
I can say that it is still an evolving research question.
So the FDA, did it have rules and regulations before vaping became available?
No. Hmm. The electronic cigarettes introduced in market in 2006, and FDA had started to regulating electronic cigarettes in 2016. So there was over a decade of marketing of electronic cigarettes without any regulation.
And as far as how they market them to adolescents, children, basically, how would that change? How might they change what they're doing?
So there are some flavors that are marketed specifically for adolescents and children. So FDA has started to regulate these flavors that appeals to younger people. And FDA is trying to make it less appealing for young tobacco naive people and make sure that electronic cigarette is being used by more appropriate consumers, like those who want to quit smoking, not experimenting with new device.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the phenomenon of e-cigarettes. My guest is Dr. Hassan Mirbalouk. He is a Johns Hopkins Hospital researcher and lead author of a new study looks at data from the Centers for Disease Control and found that more than half of the people who vape and use cigarettes, e-cigarettes, also smoke regular cigarettes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear from people who use e-cigarettes and what do you think about them. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dr. Mirbalouk, what... Does an e-cigarette have to have nicotine in it?
Yes and no. So some electronic cigarettes, some of these devices have nicotine, and some of them does not have nicotine. So especially the newer generation of this device, they have this option of adding the e-liquid by the consumer itself, so they can add whatever they want. So basically, they can add from vitamins to nicotine e-liquid, and it depends on the consumer.
Is it legal for minors to smoke or to use e-cigarettes with nicotine in them?
I'm not sure on the legal standpoint, but mm-hmm. on the health spectrum, I can say it's not a good thing to inhale anything other than air, especially for adolescents and children, those who are still at very high risk of damage to their body.
Even if it's just a flavor, it's not good?
No, it's not.
Why not?
Because when you heat up the flavors, it would create some aldehydes that we know can harm lung tissue. That's one of the very concerns that we have. The other concern about flavors are the damage that they would do to endothelial function or arteries.
Okay.
So there are some studies that shows that arterial function would be affected by these heated flavors.
When I quit 31 years ago, the program that I used focused a lot on behavior modification and changing behavior. And I've often thought that people who want to quit, if they're still vaping, they're not really changing their behavior, right?
Yes, but once again, there are some signals. The National Academy of Science recently published a report, and they specified that there is a moderate evidence, and we should be careful and cautious how to interpret this. There is a moderate evidence that e-cigarette might help some people, but not all. So, and usually, electronic cigarette and vaping for physicians is the last resort after trying smoking cessation devices that has been very truly studied. We can probably experiment with electronic cigarette, but for sure it's not the first line, although it's now the most popular of these devices.
Any parallels with people who use patches or chewing gum for smoking cessation?
Excuse me?
Any parallels with all of this? I mean, is it better if you want to use a nicotine gum or a nicotine patch? Is
yes.
that a better?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
We recommend nicotine replacement therapy, the standard recommend nicotine replacement therapy like patches or gum before even trying the electronic cigarettes, because the data around that that device is very strong, and they could help more people.
I know now that as of January 2018, federal law bans minors from purchasing or using any kind of vaping device. So now the issue is the marketing to minors on that score. The devices themselves can be attractive to minors and to anybody for that matter. Have you looked at that?
Yes, especially new devices like Juuls. There has been a boom of use among minors with these new devices. Actually, electronic cigarettes right now is the most popular tobacco product among high schoolers. So that says something about the appeal in younger people.
If you use an e-cigarette or any kind of vaping device and have a question for my guest, Dr. Hassan Mirbalouk, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Juuling has become a popular alternative to smoking. What is that, and what sets it apart from vaping and cigarettes?
So Juuls actually are the newest generation of electronic cigarettes. It's one brand, and I think the most specific thing about Juul is its packaging. It's like a thumb drive, so people can charge it with their USB port, and it makes it harder for parents or for family members to recognize this device. On the other hand, it looks really sharp, but basically it's just the same thing as any other vaping device, any other electronic cigarettes.
Is it just as easy to get addicted from vaping as it is from smoking a real cigarette?
Actually, data is evolving, but vaping has been shown to be addictive. We are not certain if it's as addictive as cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
But it has nicotine, which is the most addictive part of the cigarette. So we guess it's going to be very addictive.
Let's take a call from Tiffany in Columbus. You're on the air, Tiffany. Hi.
Hi. So I just had a comment or a question. I mean, I have coworkers who use the electronic cigarettes, and one of them experienced sores in her mouth because she would mix her own ingredients and pick her own level of nicotine for her e-cig, and it was causing the sores in her mouth. So I just wondered if you had any comments about that, about how people can make it as strong or as weak as they want, and how damaging that would be.
Dr. Mirbalouk?
Yes, that is an excellent question. So when people are making their own electronic cigarette, they should be careful. Data is strong that if people change their device on their own, especially if the battery is damaged, there is a risk of firing of the electronic cigarette, and there is also a risk of mixing some flavors that might have some adverse effect.
Thanks a lot, Tiffany, for that question. Jonathan in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Hassan Mirbalouk from Johns Hopkins. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey there, Anne. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I actually quit smoking and vaping about probably 9 months ago, and I had been vaping and smoking in total, smoking for about 3 years in total and vaping for about two of those years, kind of as a mix between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I had heard, a lot of people say is, oh, well, this stuff is just vegetable oil. You know, it can't hurt anybody. And, you know, I'm interested to see what evidence we have so far on, you know, what these potential damages might be. You know, what studies have been completed.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Dr. Mirbalouk.
So, as I said, it is still evolving. That's an excellent question, but there are some steps that should be taken to be sure how damaging electronic cigarette could be. The first is to examine the toxins in the vapes, and there are new toxins that is not anything similar to what we've seen in cigarettes. But there are the number of toxins. So if we just count the toxins,
toxin being something foreign going into your lung.
Yes.
Okay.
The number of toxin is lower among vapors than smokers.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some new toxins that researchers are worried about, and so far we don't know the extent of damage that these new toxins can make. So, but our best guess is it's healthier and safer option than smoking. But how much safer, we don't know at this moment.
And depending on the age of the person using it, is a young lung more affected than an older one, or does it really matter?
Yes, okay. For sure. Those who are still behind their puberty, the children, adolescents, they are more susceptible. And for example, another example could be pregnant individuals. So they might be more susceptible to especially their babies, to the effect of these toxins.
Jonathan, thanks for that call. And Dr. Hassan Mirbalouk, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Hassan Mirbalouk, he is a Johns Hopkins hospital researcher. He is also the lead author of a study that used data from the Centers for Disease Control, found that more than half the people who vape also that use e-cigarettes also smoke regular cigarettes. Thanks for listening today to Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.